the nation also reached the decision in the 60s that everybody ought to have access to higher education, and that became a right. And in order to implement this right, Virginia divided up the state into 23 regions, each of which was to have a two-year community college. The result would be that no citizen would have to drive more than 40 miles to get to a college, and there would be open access. Anybody could go that wanted to go. Well, that decision has been implemented since then. There are now 23 community colleges in the state of Virginia. They're all commuter colleges, no residences, all two-year colleges, and no citizen does have to drive more than about 35 or 40 miles to get to one. The most populous part of the region is in the Washington metropolitan area, northern Virginia, and that's the college where I teach. Because it is so populous, we in our college now have 28,000 students as of last September, which means we have more students in our two-year college than all the universities and four-year colleges have in Virginia. So there's a very sizable population of people who want to go to two-year colleges. We have five different campuses in order to accommodate these students, one of which is the Alexandria campus where I teach. In addition to our five campuses, we teach at a dozen or more different places. We teach classes at the Pentagon. There are two homes for the elderly down the street, and we teach classes down there in firehouses, in police stations, in high schools, in quite a few different places in order to make it convenient for citizens to get an education. So we are dealing with a very sizable population in our area, and we try to offer them as many things as they are interested in having. It's a rather technically oriented two-year college, that is to say it's oriented toward careers. Something like 40% of our students go on to a four-year college or university, but the rest don't. They're there for a very specific purpose. They want a course or a two-year degree or a one-year certificate or a three-month course in air conditioning or what have you. In the 1960s, a lot of changes were attempted in education, things like programmed instruction, teaching machines. A lot of experimentation went on, and some experimentation was tried in the use of computers in education. Unfortunately, most of the experimentation with computers didn't work very well. The problem was that the typical scenario would be that a couple of teachers said, hey, you notice there's a big computer over in the admissions and records department. They don't use it very much. Maybe we could use it for education. So what they tried to do was to take a machine that was designed and programmed for a totally different purpose and then adapt it somehow to education. And usually it didn't work very well. Or the other scenario was that the IBM man came around and said, I've got this secondhand computer that nobody wants and I'll give it to you for 20% of the original cost. Well, it sounded like such a bargain that a number of schools bought them. And in a sense, it was a bargain, except that it was designed for a different purpose. And so the results were not too encouraging. A few people did have good success, like Patrick Soupy's at the University of California, and a few other places where they tried very simple things like drill and practice. But for the most part, it was strictly experimental. In the late 60s, the National Science Foundation decided that the only way to move to a higher level was to pump a lot of money quickly into computer-assisted instruction. So they selected two experiments to put a lot of money into, a lot meaning $5 or $6 million each. One of them was the Plato system at the University of Illinois, run by Dr. Bitzer. His vision was to have an enormous computer with thousands of students hooked into it over thousands of square miles using telephone lines for the connection. Unfortunately, he is a computer genius, but his expertise is in the machines and the way they're used, not in education. And so he designed this beautiful system, but he didn't put anything on it. He left that to individual teachers to write the instructional material. It's a very interesting arrangement, but unfortunately, most of the stuff that was written for it was pretty trashy, because any old teacher could sit down and compose something and put it on there. It's been going long enough now that they finally do have some decent instructional material, but it's a very different approach from the one that I'm used to. The other major effort was the ticket system, which is the one that I'm involved in. That's an acronym that stands for Time-Shared Interactive Computer-Controlled Information Television. That's the first thing you memorize when you work with the system. the ticket system had a completely different genesis. It started essentially at the University of Texas in Austin, where there was a computer lab which was doing a lot of educational experimentation. In particular, David Merrill and Victor Bunderson were psychologists and learning theorists who were very interested in the use of computers. So they got together with the MITRE Corporation in Washington. MITRE is a research and development corporation, a nonprofit group that works mostly with the government. And they said to themselves, suppose I had complete freedom to design an educational system that embodied all of the research results and the best guesses that we have, what would it look like? In other words, don't start with any machine at all, just start with learning theory. What are the things that ought to go into good instruction? And if you're going to use a computer, what kind of extra advantages does that give you? So they designed a teaching system which would, they hope, embody all of the results that they knew from educational research. And in fact, they wrote down a whole list of assumptions that they were going to go on in the construction of this system. Now, in some cases, the assumptions are supported by research. In other cases, they're not. They're just guesses as to what works better than something else. But it's a delightful thing for an educator in this sense that it's designed for research. It's based on some very explicit assumptions, which may be true or may be false. But because they're so explicit, it will be possible in the future to run experiments to see whether or not these assumptions are valid or not. Later on, I'll talk about what a few of these assumptions are. So they started with learning theory, and the three components that go into a system are the hardware and the software and the courseware. Hardware means the machines that you use. And in fact, they didn't invent any machines at all. They just took off-the-shelf items, some mini computers that were in wide use already, some Sony color television sets, the same as the one you might have in your house. MITRE did have to invent a few minor things, but mostly it was just off-the-shelf machinery. Software means the programs written by professional programmers that make the system operate, and there's a huge amount of software in there. One of the programmers told me that if the paper and pencil versions were stacked up, it would be about 10 feet tall, and it represents maybe a $2 million worth of employment, a programmer's time to compose all of those programs. Courseware is the technical term, which means the instructional material that the student sees. The student never sees the software. That's the guts inside that makes the computers work. The courseware is the instructional material that he sees on the screen. I had a hand in writing some of the courseware. My college was selected, along with Phoenix Community College, to be a demonstration site for this ticket system. And so I and an English teacher from my college and a couple of teachers from Phoenix were sent to Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, where the courseware was composed. Merrill and Bunderson were both Mormons, and they wanted to move back to BYU anyway, so they moved the whole courseware effort back there, and I spent about 7 months out there helping write that stuff. In 1974, the system was installed in my college, five math courses and an English course, and we started using them. Unfortunately, we discovered that a lot of the courseware, the actual instructional material, was not in very good shape. One reason was that the effort at BYU wasn't too well managed, and so they didn't finish. They didn't get a chance to go through and debug what they had done, and they couldn't even finish what they were supposed to do. Another problem was that most of the authors there came from BYU, and their culture was reflected in the courseware. So you'd see statements in there, for example, a sentence in English given as an example of something. During the week, we go to bed at 9 o'clock, and on weekends at 10. Well, that may be in BYU, but it isn't true in Washington. We don't go to bed at 9 o'clock on weekdays and at 10 o'clock on weekends. And so it just was bizarre. It would be bizarre to our students to see that. It also had a very sexist bias. Mormon theology, as you know, is very clear about the roles of men and women, and it's not the roles that the rest of us assign. And so the female students were highly incensed at some of the things they saw in the courseware. So we have had to spend a lot of time and a lot of money rewriting the courseware in order to make it more appropriate for our students. Also, during that period, three of the math courses became very unpopular, and so we just took that part off the computer. So we're left with two math courses, remedial math courses, and an English grammar course. The facilities that we have for it, first of all, involve a separate room on the top floor of the building where the computer machinery is housed. It's a room about two-thirds the size of this room. Unfortunately, I don't have very good slides. They're pale compared to the beautiful things that SIG has done. I just had to grab these from people's files. Anyway, this is a standard mini computer. There are two of them, one for handling pulling out the courseware as needed, and the other one, the terminal processor, is connected to all the individual terminals that the students are seated at. In addition to that, there's a set of senders that will send out videotapes. Most of the displays that the students see on their TV screen are static displays. However, it is possible to send out videotapes, and in some cases you can also put commercial television through, but we don't do that very often, and we only do it for the faculty on bowl games and World Series and things like that. The students don't have access to commercial television, but it is possible to do it. Also in the computer room you have the usual kinds of peripherals, some tape drives. There are six big disk drives that contain the electronic material, the software and the courseware, and various other odds and ends that are of no interest except to a hardware person. There are 128 student terminals attached to, by cables, to the computer room. Most of them are placed in a learning lab, which also houses a language lab and a testing lab. So the students are seated at individual carrels. They're not far away from each other, so they're not totally isolated, but each student has his own set. When the student comes in and sits down at a set, this is what he sees, a Sony color TV and a keyboard. The displays all appear on the television set. The keyboard enables him to talk to the computer, to tell the computer what he wants. One of the interesting aspects of this system is that, unlike the rest of your life, here the computer does not tell you what to do, you tell the computer what to do. This is one of the assumptions of the designers of the system, namely that learners, by and large, should be in control of the learning system, that they should make the decisions. So it's very different from a classroom. With very few exceptions, the computer never tells the student what to do. The student always tells the computer. The keyboard looks a little forbidding, but in fact, the students usually learn how to operate it in about an hour, no more than that. The middle part of it is just an electric typewriter. On the right and left sides, there are some extra keys that I'll show you in more detail in a few moments. And those extra keys are the things that enable you to very quickly access material. If you want to look at an explanation of something, you just press one button, and there it is. So it's a very simple thing to operate. It takes only about an hour to learn how to do it. So the students work at individual carrels. When he sits down and looks at the first display, he has to type in his number and the password and the course that he's involved in, then presses an enter key, and then that's his way of saying hello to the computer. And then the computer knows who he is, where to find his records, and what course he wants to work in. A ticket course is a very highly analyzed creature, and that's one reason why they're expensive to write. The course is divided up into units. Each of the unit is divided into lessons, and each lesson is divided up into segments. A segment teaches only one concept or one rule. So it's a very small amount of instruction in terms of the ground that you cover. When you write a ticket course, you have to spend a lot of time analyzing just what it is you want to teach, because you have to structure everything in this format, units, lessons, and segments. Most teachers take a fairly global approach. They'll say, well, I'll deal with polynomials this week and something else next week, and of course they have it organized more or less, but you have to go way beyond that if you're going to put instructional material on the ticket system. It has to be very highly analyzed. When the student tells the computer he wants a particular course, he then goes through a series of maps or diagrams that show him what is available. When he first designates the course that he wants, he gets a course map that shows him a picture of the different units that make up the course, indicated by little boxes. I apologize for the slide, but it's very hard to take a picture of a TV screen for some reason. It just doesn't work very well, unless you're extremely clever at photography. So the little boxes indicate all of the units that make up the course. And then he tells the computer which unit he wants to work on, and he gets a second level map that shows him the lessons that make up that unit, And then he says what lesson he wants to work on. Then he gets a third level map that show him the segments that make up the lessons. You'll notice that there's some color coding of the boxes. That's another handy thing for the student. As he progresses through the course, all of these boxes that represent pieces of instruction become color coded. When he finishes a lesson, the lesson box is turned green. If he fails the test, it's turned red. If he starts it but hasn't finished it, it's turned yellow. So every time he goes back the next day to start studying again, he has a complete record there of what he's done, what lessons he's passed, which ones he still has to, which lesson tests he still has to take. That's very handy for him. It's also very handy for the teacher, because I, as an instructor, can type in the student's number later on and see exactly how much work he's finished and what he hasn't finished. There's a huge amount of material available to him. This is another picture of a typical map where some of the segments have been color-coded. When a student goes to a particular segment to study a particular concept, most people, when you study something, want an explanation. What is this concept? What is its definition? Or what is the rule that I'm supposed to learn? So he has available to him explanatory material. The ticket system is deliberately very redundant. Instead of writing one explanation, we write four explanations in case he has trouble with one of them. The first one, the rule, is the sort of standard kind of thing that you'd see in a textbook. It defines whatever is to be defined, or explains what a rule is and how to use it. If a student doesn't get it, he has the option of looking at these other versions. The Rule Easy is a very imaginative presentation. It's based often on a metaphor or an image of some kind. And people say that they can always recognize the Rule Easies that I've written, because I have a kind of bizarre imagination. I think of weird analogies. But the point is to get the student to get the core of the idea, not to worry about all the technical details, just to, you know, that aha experience. Yeah, I see essentially what it's about. For more grubby details, he can look at the rule help, which is usually a series of two or three examples worked out step by step in great detail. Step one, do this. Step two, do that. Even if you don't understand it, if you do these steps, you'll get the right answer. The rule hard is a very succinct version that's used mostly for review purposes. And the student can look at any one or several of these as many times as he wants in any order that he wants. So he may look at one and then go immediately elsewhere, or he may spend a lot of time there. He's in control of the situation. In addition to the explanatory material, there are examples and practice problems and helps for each of them. The practice problems in most cases are divided up into three levels of difficulty, all of which the student is in control of. Same for examples. For each example and for each practice problem, he has available to him a help which explains that particular example or practice problem. So for example, if he's asked in a practice problem to give the root of some equation, he types in his answer, and the computer comes back and tells him if he's right or wrong, and sometimes gives him further information. That's the most interesting part for an author, how to analyze a student's answer. For instance, as a teacher, I know from experience that in a certain kind of math problem, the typical mistake is to do such and such. All right. So I can anticipate that as an author and tell the computer, first look at this as the right answer and compare it to the student's answer. If they're the same, tell him he's right. Then compare his answer to this typical wrong answer. And if that's the wrong answer he's got, then tell him, sorry, Johnny, what you did was add instead of subtract on step two. And that can be very spooky to the student. You know, how does the computer know I added instead of subtracted? Well, the computer knows it because I know it as an experienced teacher.
Are the students working out on paper?
Yes, they have pencil and paper for, you know, scratch work. The computer also will compute if the student wants that. He can press a couple of buttons. You know, if he has several calculations, he doesn't have to do them by hand. He can access the computer part of the computer, and then the computer will do the arithmetic for him. So as far as possible, we try to anticipate what wrong answers the students are going to give and then explain immediately in the feedback why that was the wrong answer and give him a chance to try again. If he doesn't understand the problem, or if he's not sure why he's made a mistake and it's just a random mistake that we can't anticipate, then he can ask for help and there will be an explanation there of exactly how to do that particular problem or what is the meaning of that particular example.
How great is analysis of what he did wrong is incorrect? I mean, how great is the risk of that, or how damaging can that?
usually very slight. Most math errors are random errors of arithmetic. You know, you just multiply wrong and a digit gets out of place.
Yeah.
There are very specific errors that are made because a student has the rule incorrectly understood. And the chance of a random error being exactly that plausible wrong answer is minute.
Yeah.
So we always put it conditionally. We say, you probably did such and such.
Yeah. Yeah.
And another thing, we hardly ever say wrong to a student, because especially young students always try to outwit the computer. If he's supposed to type in the number 6, they'll type in S-I-X, just to see if they can fool the computer. And so the message is often, we don't recognize your answer, try again. Because if you say wrong, they'll immediately jump up, aha, I beat the computer. And of course, on multiple choice items, only a minority of the questions are multiple choice, but on those, you can be very sure about it. If he chooses the answer C, he's almost surely got a certain reason in his head for doing it, so you can respond to that supposed reason. There are large numbers of problems in a typical segment. I might write, say, a dozen easy problems, a dozen medium problems, and a dozen hard problems. Well, if you're only testing one little concept, 36 problems is usually more than enough. So the students have lots of chance to practice. That's one of the attractive features to many students in a remedial course, that they don't have to be embarrassed about doing a lot of practice problems. Nobody knows. In a classroom, if the teacher does 2 or 3 problems and you still don't get it, it's kind of embarrassing to say, I'm stupid, I don't get it, you got to do 10 more problems for me. But here, nobody knows, since it's self-instructional. One of the nicest keys on the keyboard is a key marked advice. The students are often somewhat lacking in self-confidence, and they're not sure how they're doing and what they ought to do next, so they can press the advice key and ask the computer to advise them. The computer keeps track of everything that the student has seen. It keeps a running score on all the practice problems that he's done. So it may advise him, for instance, it starts with a practice score of 50, and every time you do a practice problem right, it goes up. If you do one wrong, it goes down. So having done a bunch of problems, you can ask for advice, and it may say, your score on the easy problems is 85 or something. Don't do any more of those. Your score on the hard problems is still 50. You ought to do at least 2 more of those. So it's a very primitive kind of advice, but still students find it very useful. They tend to take the computer's word. If the computer says, we don't advise doing any more problems, they won't, by and large. And sometimes, even without pressing advice, the computer will intervene. Suddenly you get a display that says, we recommend you go on to the next segment. You've done enough of these, right? Don't spend any more time on it. Again, that's only advice. You can override it if you want to. This is a picture of the, or not a picture, a diagram of the right half of the keyboard. The designers tried to make the system very easy to use so that you don't have to type a lot of things. So for instance, if you want to see a rule, you just press the button in the lower left corner that says rule. That's all. One key press does it for you. And if you want to look at the other versions of the rule, the second row says help, hard, and easy. Those will give you the other 3 versions of the rule. So a single key press gets it to you. To get an example or practice problem, you just press the key in the lower right there. If you're looking at that and you want to help, you press the help key. And this time it gives you a practice help instead of a rule help. So by and large, a single key press is enough to get you what you want. The advice key is on the right, as you can see there. Back key means you can go back to the example you were looking at before you asked for some help, and so on. The note key means you can write notes to your instructor or to the computer. Some of them are obscene, some are not. And the student has the option of signing his name to it or not. Usually the obscene ones are not signed. There aren't too many of those, just occasionally somebody gets annoyed. It's also helpful for finding typographical errors. If a student finds a wrong answer or a typographical error, very often they'll type a little note in saying this thing's wrong here. Makes them feel good. This is the keys to the left of the center of the keyboard. The enter key is a page turner. If a rule, for instance, has 4 or 5 pages, by pressing the enter key, you flip from one display to another. The arrowed keys enable the student to move a little typing box around in any direction on the screen. For instance, in an English course, you might be asked to mark the word that is spelled incorrectly. and there's a little typing box, and you can move it around the screen and position it on top of the word that's spelled incorrectly, and then press the mark key, and that's like putting your finger on it. The A to the X enables you to type superscripts and subscripts, and so on. The rest are not of too much interest. They're used more by authors than by students. We have tried, the designers of the system tried to build into it all of the ideas which were thought to be good ideas that educational researchers had come up with. The idea of giving a student the chance of getting a sense of context before he starts. He can look at material in survey mode without doing any practice problems. He can just look through the rules to get a sense of what he's going to be studying. And there are introductions, there are objectives for each of the segments, and so on. Pegs to hang things on, as my Greek teacher used to say. The student can decide for himself what tactics to use in learning things. He has rules, he has examples and practice. Some are easier, some are harder. He can move back and forth in his own pattern amongst all this instructional material in any way that he finds most profitable. The so-called all-American strategy is you look at the rule, or maybe a couple of versions of it, then you look at a couple of examples, then you look at practice problems. Maybe half or more of the students follow that pattern pretty consistently. Other students, however, do things very differently. Some students jump right into the practice problems without ever looking at the explanation. I find that bizarre, but then if they find it helpful, who am I to tell them not to do it that way? If that's the way they like to learn, that's fine. So they decide their own tactics and strategy. You need to evaluate what you're doing when you're learning, and the practice problems help you do that because every time you do a problem, you get feedback from the computer. And every test has a lesson that goes with it. And then finally, you have to be able to review because there's a cumulative test at the end of the course, and you can go back and review all of the material that you've seen, except that you can't get back to the tests because we want to, you know. When you use computer-assisted instruction, the management of it turns out to be more significant than you'd think at first. And we've tried various arrangements, and we finally come up with the following. Just as the student in the lecture section of this remedial math course would meet, say, 5 days a week for 1 hour in a classroom, so the ticket students are scheduled to meet 1 hour a day for 5 days a week. So they do have scheduled time with a specific instructor. However, the system is running about 12 hours a day, so they are free to come in at any time during the day in addition to their scheduled hours. And in fact, they have to if they expect to finish the course. We found that a typical student who finishes a course in one quarter spends about 65 hours. That's like 6 or 7 hours a week on the average. So in addition to their scheduled hours, they need to put in some extra hours. Of course, there's no homework, so it all balances out. The reason for scheduling specific hours, when in fact they could just come in any old time, is to build up a relationship with an instructor. That's still important, even though the instructor's role is totally different. Next quarter, I will have a section of ticket math. I will not give any lectures whatever. The entire course is taught by the computer, but I still have a role to play. I have to come in there and keep track of what all the students are doing to help them get a sense of the pace that they're going at. It's very easy when you are deciding all the time what to do next to get sloppy, unfortunately, to take it easy. If you've got an English paper due tomorrow, well, let's forget about the computer will understand. The computer never scolds you, unlike a teacher in a classroom. So it's easy to sort of slack off in a course taught by a computer. So it's very useful to have an instructor there who's keeping an eye on things and can give you encouragement, and to be a kind of court of last resort. If you've looked at all of the instructional material and you still don't get it, there's always an instructor around to help you. And that is required. You can't always anticipate every student's problem with a given concept. Some courses are taught like the math course, that is to say they're described as mainline instruction. The entire course is taught by the computer. In other cases, the computer is used adjunctively. In our English 110 course, for instance, they spend half their time in a classroom talking about composition, writing, and the other half in the learning lab working on ticket learning English grammar. So it's a combination of two things. Originally, the whole course was supposed to be on the computer, but they discovered after beating their heads for a year or two that you can't teach English composition by a computer. They should have known it in the first place, but it took them that long to figure it out. But you can teach English grammar, because that's a very rigid, mechanical kind of thing. There are other ways of using it adjunctively. Our biology, basic biology course now has its testing or part of it on Ticket. And eventually all of it will be on there. So their labs and their classroom lectures are the normal ones, but for their tests, of which they have 5 or 6 every quarter, they all come to the learning lab, and that's all done by computer. But we're planning on some small modules to assist our other science courses. For instance, in our geology and oceanography courses, they are described in the catalog as beginning lab courses. So the students, for the most part, have never had chemistry and biology. That makes it very hard to teach oceanography, which assumes some of those concepts. So the teachers in those courses have to teach a little bit of chemistry and a little bit of biology and a little bit of math and so on. But they go over it quickly in order to get to their own material. So we are going to be writing some small modules so that after these things have been covered in class, the students can then go to the computer to do more practice on atomic structure, the use of logarithms, and how to use graphs and that sort of thing. So it will be adjunctive to several other courses. Well, the most reasonable question to ask is, does it all work? What are the advantages and disadvantages of an admittedly expensive system? I'll try to give you as honestly as I can some of the advantages and the disadvantages. One advantage I've already mentioned is that it's based on a specific set of assumptions which then can be tested out, and if they turned out to be wrong, they can be revised, and the system can then be revised. One of these assumptions is that most school subjects can be described in a taxonomy that David Merrill worked up. A very useful way of analyzing school materials, after many years of thinking about it, decided that most school subjects can be divided up in two ways according to content and according to the behavior that you expect of the student. And in terms of content, you have things like paired associates, you know, Columbus, 1492. It's a pair of things that you're supposed to associate. There are concepts, rules, and problems. The kinds of behavior that you normally ask for in school subjects are basically four. This obviously is not going to be all-inclusive. First of all, recall or memorization. Second, classification. Thirdly, rule using. And fourth, rule finding. Now, a concept might be something like the concept of a first degree equation. Essentially, what you want a student to be able to do is to classify and say, yes, this is or this isn't a first degree equation. Now you notice the way these boxes are stacked up here. This indicates that for a certain kind of content, a student has to exhibit maybe more than one kind of behavior. If I ask a student, is this a first degree equation or not, first of all, he has to classify, he has to use the definition, but to use it, he has to remember it. So he's showing two kinds of behavior. If I just said to the student, recite to me the definition of a first degree equation, he's only using his memory. And that's no indication of whether or not he can actually classify things. With rules, for instance, the quadratic formula, that calls for rule using behavior. If I say, use the quadratic formula to solve this equation, he's got to remember what the formula is, he's got to be able to identify the different aspects of the equation and how they relate to the formula, and he's got to use the formula. For open-ended problems, he's got to decide what are the right rules to use, not just use a given rule. So we'd have to use all four kinds of behavior. Now obviously that does not cover all kinds of human learning, and it isn't intended to, but it's a very handy tool for analyzing instructional material in schools. It does cover most of it. That's a very broad claim, but I still believe that that's an extremely useful taxonomy of learning. It helps make you honest about what you're testing, for instance. If you ask a student just to recite a rule, you're not testing his rule-using behavior, and he may not be able to do that. He may only have memorized it. Another item in the area of learning theory that goes into the system has to do with advanced organizers. David Ausubel in the 60s did a lot of research into the usefulness of giving people pegs to hang things on. Most educational research, as you probably know, is an investigation of the obvious. And the conclusions usually support good common sense. So in one sense, it looks like a waste of time, but in another sense, it is a verification, or a non-verification in some cases, of what good teachers have always known. And it is good to give people a sense of context. Some of the research is a little more detailed and maybe not quite so obvious. For instance, in teaching concepts, a good math teacher will always give a student not only examples of a concept, but also non-examples. I'll say to him, here's a picture of a parallelogram, and here's a picture of something that isn't a parallelogram, just to make sure he can tell the difference between the two. Well, they have done research on the most effective way of presenting examples and non-examples, and the research showed a significant improvement in students if you present simultaneously an example and a non-example, instead of, say, on successive pages. So when we show a computer display that has an example, it's always a concept. It's always accompanied by a non-example. I say, here's an example of a first-degree equation, blah, blah, blah. This equation, however, blah, 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 is not a first-degree equation. Furthermore, when you present examples and non-examples that way, they have found that it aids learning if the irrelevant attributes are as similar as possible. Now, that's a jawbreaker. What it means is that if you're presenting an example and a non-example, the parts that don't matter should look a lot alike so that the student's attention is focused on the important part. For example, if I'm going to give them some equation, and I say 2x plus 3 is equal to 7, that's an example of a first-degree equation. And if I say 1/2 x squared plus 9 is equal to 10, that's a non-example of a first-degree equation. The irrelevant parts are the 2 and the half and the 9 and the 3 and the 7 and the 10. Those don't have anything to do with deciding whether or not it's first degree. The only thing that matters is whether it's a second power or a first power on the x. Now, if all of my examples looked like that, the student might conclude, aha, whenever there's a fraction, that's what distinguishes between first and second degree. And that's not the definition. So I deliberately write things like 2x plus 3 equals 7 and 2x squared plus 3 equals 7. In order to focus his attention on the one thing that's really crucial, namely the exponent. So the irrelevant parts should be similar, not identical necessarily, but similar. On the other hand, when you have a sequence of pairs of examples and non-examples, the examples should have their irrelevant parts as dissimilar as possible. If all of my examples were 2x plus 3 equals 7, 2x plus 8 equals 9, if I always had a 2 here, a student might get the idea that it was the 2 that made the thing first degree. So I should have as diverse numbers in there as possible in my examples, so that the student will see the entire breadth of the concept. But it doesn't matter. These things can vary very widely as long as you have a first degree, a first power on the x. So successive examples should have irrelevant parts as dissimilar as possible. Well, those are examples of some of the principles that are built into the system and which I think make a lot of sense. Another advantage of the system, a positive thing, is that it has worked in practice. Last fall, for instance, or last year, we did a study of the ticket students in the remedial math courses and those who were in lecture sections. And we found that we tracked one group of students that started in September. At the end of the first quarter, more of the lecture students had received a satisfactory grade and completed the course than ticket students. But if you kept on following those students who were allowed to re-enroll in the course, by the end of the year, a higher percentage of that original group had completed the course in the ticket students than compared to the lecture sections. And that's a very worthwhile thing. Remedial courses, as you know, are very hard to teach and don't have a very high success rate generally. So any improvement you can make there is really worth making. Another advantage is that we like to give students a choice of ways to learn. We have never considered this computer thing to be the one and only way to learn. It's just one option among many. And we're always going to continue that philosophy. The system is very flexible in the way the students can use it. For instance, last month a student came up and said, I'm registering for your course on ticket next quarter. However, for the first 2 weeks of the quarter, I'm going to be doing my military service. He's in the reserves. Well, that doesn't matter. He can come in 2 weeks late, and absolutely nothing is lost. So it's lovely to have that kind of flexibility, because people do get into, you know, funny situations where they don't fit the system. Well, the system fits them in this case. It's also very useful in terms of testing. By next year, we will be able to do a lot of analyses of the tests, and that will be very revealing. If certain test items consistently are gotten wrong, that tells us either that the test item is bad or that the course isn't teaching that concept well. And so we will be able to analyze, since the computer remembers everything, we will be able to analyze the results of the practice items and the test items. On the negative side, the system is costly at present. We got it for free because we were part of this demonstration sponsored by NSF. If you were to walk into the commercial vendor that has now taken over the system from MITRE, it would cost you over $1 million to get the computers and the 128 terminals. I doubt that it's ever going to be, quote, cost-effective in the sense that it's going to save you money. It won't save you money. If it's justifiable, it's justifiable because it's educationally effective, because it does some things educationally that you couldn't otherwise do. Cost may well go down. We had a demonstration recently by a man from Radio Shack showing their beautiful $600 computer. For a mere $600, you can buy your own computer now. Now, it won't do very much until you add some things onto it, and by then you're up to $3,000 or $4,000. But even so, with $3,000 or $4,000, you can do what would have cost you maybe $100,000 10 years ago. The field of computing is very bizarre. The cost of one operation, and I'm not quite sure how they measure it, but the cost of one operation has been decreasing rapidly for the last 15 years. It's the only thing in our inflationary economy where the cost is going down. And it's down like down a 45-degree slope, that down fast, not just slightly down. So an operation this year may cost you half what it cost you last year. However, the other side of the coin is that because computers are faster, we now ask them to do more things, so you end up spending just as much money anyway. However, it is distinctly possible that with the new generation of microprocessors that are coming along, the total cost of a ticket system may go down very rapidly. Mini computers is a technology that came out of the late 60s, so it's an old technology now. The new technology may be a lot cheaper. Another negative side of computer-assisted instruction that we've noticed is that it does require a little bit more motivation and perseverance on the part of the students. Some students get through only because they're in a classroom and the teacher badgers them constantly. If you don't have a nagging teacher, the students won't do the work and they won't get through. I'm not sure how much a student really learns in that context, but at least they do get through. We don't badger and nag students that much when they're on ticket. In fact, it's almost impossible to do. So some students do get sloppy, they don't finish the course, they may re-enroll two or three times and still not finish. It's a problem. We try to encourage them as much as possible, but it does require more independence on the part of the student. Finally, it's very costly to write courseware, good courseware. You can write trash cheaply, but you can't write good courseware without a lot of expense. To write a one-quarter course that's mainline, that teaches the entire thing, might well cost $30,000 to $50,000. That's a big investment. And I doubt that that's going to change, because that's people time, that's not technology. Authoring on ticket is very different from anything you've ever done. I wrote three textbooks in the late 50s and early 60s, and it's completely different from writing a textbook. It's not like writing anything else. If anything, it's like doing a cartoon, because you're writing for television. You're not writing for a book, so you can't just write words and sentences. You've got a visual thing. As an author, you have seven colors you can play with. You can do graphics. You can get artists to draw pictures and have those embedded as part of your text. Students will not read a screen that is heavily laden with words. It's just the way we react to television. If you fill up a television screen with a paragraph, they won't read it. And you wouldn't either if you look at it. It's very boring and tiring to see lots of word on a TV screen. So it's a very different mode of authoring. It takes a lot of practice and training, yes.
I don't understand. In the textbook business, if you wrote the textbook, then mass production meant that it was a fairly inexpensive item. Could not other schools that had ticket get good courseware
right
with the first expenditure of $50,000? Wouldn't
right
the other, wouldn't the duplication of that be less?
Yes, if that comes about. Very few, at present, only two schools have ticket. three actually. The Model Secondary School for the Deaf has a system, but they don't use it very much. If this kind of system became widespread, yes, then that initial investment in authoring could be sort of parceled out, or it could be done commercially, so that a commercial person would do it. It is costly. Somebody's got to pay for it, and at present my college is paying for it. So on balance, we are very happy with the system. It has taken a lot of our money, but it has done some good things. We have great plans for the future. We have two grants at the moment from National Science Foundation to study our science courses and to find out how we can use the system to support them, not supplant them, but supplement them, by creating small modules. For instance, very often students in science courses can't do the math. So we will create some math modules tailored to our science courses so that the science teachers won't have to spend their time in class going over things. They have asked, for example, to have a lot of video clips put on the ticket system. For instance, some concepts, say the shape of a certain molecule and how it behaves in a certain situation, very hard to visualize. So if we can get a good movie or a video clip and cut it down to just what they want and have it available 12 hours a day on the system, then a science student can just walk up to any terminal and plug in the right numbers and watch this video clip over and over and over until he can see and get hold of what's actually happening. They think that would be extremely advantageous. Also for something like lab safety. At present, they give a pre-lab before doing a lab, and part of that is to tell the students about what's dangerous. Well, you know, students wander in late and they've missed the lecture on the safety part. Well, that's a problem for the school. One, we don't want the students to get hurt. Two, we don't want to be liable if they are. So one way out is to have the safety part on a video clip. And before you do an experiment, you've got to sit down and look at that clip and maybe answer a few questions on it correctly and be certified by the computer as ready to do the experiment. So we see all sorts of applications. It's going to be used as part of our registration system. It can be used as an in-house television system. There are all sorts of possibilities for the future. So we're not going to throw it away by any means. We intend to keep developing it, primarily because it's good educationally, but it also has some secondary uses. Questions?
It seems to me that one of the appealing things, the only way I can really visualize it is as it relates to math, I guess. I have a hard time visualizing how the courseware would look for a for a literature course. Mm-hmm. Like that. But I just think the novelty of playing with it would be very, very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
I was wandering through the halls at Valparais University about 4 years ago, and there was a little room there, and a student was sitting there at a console. And I was able to stand outside and look over her shoulder and watch what she was doing. And the courseware that was on that system, I had no idea what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, the computer came back with, it was just great. Rejoinders, retorts like, you dummy, why did you do that? And it was just really, it was just enjoyable. I think
we found you have to be very careful in the things you say. If you say, you dummy, so some students are going to be very offended by that, so we're very cautious about humor.
In order to make it effective, you really got to put some sort of appealing stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
You got to make the computer seem kind of human, right?
We try, and there are also games that students can play on it. There are about a dozen games, like Concentration and Hangman and Bagels and Battleship and quite a number of other things. When students are at their terminal, you have to check every once in a while to see if they're playing a game or doing their course. We don't know what courses or what parts of courses can be put on and what can't. You mentioned literature, for instance. It seems most unlikely to me that the computer is of much use in an area like that.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I've had history teachers say, gee, I wish we could get part of our history course on there. Well, that's hard for me to visualize, but he could.
Mm-hmm.
The history teacher could.
Yeah.
So it's very much open-ended. We just don't know what the limits of the usefulness of the system are. Mm-hmm.
What about the possibility that are explored of being able to rent to a student someday something that they would hook into their television set and then they would simply call a number and put the receiver on that and do this process in their own home?
That's coming. In fact, that was part of the original design. MITRE is in McLean, Virginia, which is not very far from Reston, and that's a new town, completely built in the last 10 years or so. And part of the original design was to have the ticket system as part of their cable TV system. So it was so designed that if you had a touch telephone, by pressing the right buttons, you would be in touch with the computer and could submit your answers over the telephone. So that's coming, I'm sure. The technology of it isn't quite finished yet. With some things you can send easily over telephone wires and some you can't, and how much of the computer equipment has to be duplicated at different sites, they're still working out the details, but that's coming. You'll have your own computer in your own home.
What were the times when power shortage and something else wiped you out in the PhD thesis or in ticket?
Right.
What is that?
John's referring to a period when I was writing a separate little course having nothing to do with our instruction to do an experiment for my PhD. At that time, there were two problems. Number one, the system was still being constructed, and so it was in a primitive state, and it kept doing funny things, like erasing everything I wrote. Some things I had to type in 15 times before the computer finally took them. That's all gone now. I mean, the system is now mature, so there's no problem there. There is a limited problem in the sense that, especially in the summertime when you have thunderstorms, that there will be power surges, and the computer will cut off instantly in order to protect itself. When that happens, the disk drives may crash, which means some of the dots and dashes on those disks will get scratched or scrambled or something, and then the computer will refuse to use that disk because it knows there are mistakes in there. In that case, you may lose several hours' work, and the student records for the last couple of hours may have been lost. You have to go to a backup pack, which may be several hours out of date. So as an author, I may lose half a day's work or something, but no more than that. He might have to tell his instructor, look, I took this test this morning and now my map is black again,
yeah.
So I'll just go in and color it green for him. One of the things I worry about is the whole question of high technology, low technology. I certainly would not recommend something like this for the third or fourth or fifth world countries. It's a high technology, and what you need, I think, in their kinds of economies is things that are not capital intensive, but people intensive. So in other economies, it makes more sense to have a couple of hundred graduate assistants around helping out instead of putting money into a machine, because that would promote employment. But in our situation, I think a good argument can be made for something that's capital intensive. We have never fired a teacher because of this system and never expect to, so it doesn't cut down on the number of teachers.
How many in a course?
In my section, I might have 25 or 30.
Yeah.
And it's no trouble to handle 30 students because I don't have to be with them constantly. Strangely enough, students tell us that they get more individual attention in a ticket section from their teacher than they would in a classroom. Since I'm not busy lecturing, I can spend the whole period going around talking to individuals.
Oh, you are there that hour.
For that hour,
you're
I'm there.
Around to the
yes.
Consoles.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It isn't that you're just in an office. If
no, I'm there wandering about. So I can spend 10 minutes with one student if he really needs it.
Problem.
Typing skills.
Spelling.
Yes.
Spelling.
Yeah, we're very cautious about that. For instance, when you get to long polynomials or something, we'll switch and start having multiple choice problems instead of having a student type in a long string of complicated symbols. And in the grammar course, they tend to use different kinds of exercises, like mark the misspelled word. They just have to press one button.
But gosh, isn't part of that learning process having to write off those complicated symbols?
Yes, but there's a limit. Writing by hand is a lot easier than typing on a keyboard, unless you're a good typist.
Mm-hmm.
In English, they do have to learn to use the insert
good.
And justify keys so that they can insert words in a sentence. So they do have to become a little bit sophisticated.
It'd be a nice way to promote good spelling.
Mm-hmm.
If the computer won't accept your answer.
Right, there are spelling exercises, too. There's an audio component so that the computer will speak the words to them and then they have to type them out. It's audio. It's computerized speech, though. They have a system whereby a human being will speak the word and then it's analyzed very finely and then translated into dots and dashes and stored in the computer electronically, not in an audio fashion like you would have on a phonograph record, but the way anything else is stored in a computer, and then it's reconstituted. And it comes out sounding pretty natural. It's not the R2-D2, you will spell the word. It doesn't sound like that at all. You can tell the difference between two people's voices. It's that realistic. If a student is supposed to type in a word.
Yeah, on a specific
on a spelling bee, yeah.
It
gives them a little bit of leeway. Unless you tell the computer differently, it'll let you make like one letter wrong in the word and it'll still recognize it. These are remedial courses, Mark, and so it's pass-fail. Or they may just want to brush up. Maybe they don't want college math, but they need high school math.
Yeah.
Why were three courses dropped? What were they?
It was a sequence of three courses, and they were not transferable. And so as students and counselors became aware of that, they started telling students, don't take this sequence, take this other sequence, which is transferable to another college.
For the last 2 years of college, or just transferable?
They just wouldn't be, they weren't accepted as college credits. They were too close to being a high school course.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.